Hey, everybody. Today's episode of Day 2 Cloud is sponsored by Datadog, and you've probably heard them. They're a pretty popular monitoring platform for cloud-scale infrastructure and applications. If you'd like to know more, you can visit datadog.com/day2cloud and get your free Datadog t-shirt. That's datadog.com/day2cloud.
Welcome to Day 2 Cloud. You got Ethan here and Ned, and we're talking about cloud disaster recovery. I don't know if we're recovering cloud, Neds, or we're creating disasters, or what exactly the strategy is here, but we're doing it. It's happening. It's happening, buddy.
Well, one could argue that cloud is already a disaster in many aspects, but that's not what we're here to talk about.
You've made it, today. Maybe that could be the show. You've made a disaster in your cloud. Time to recover. No, but it isn't. This is actually a traditional disaster recovery conversation that we want to have. Only we're going to freshen it up, so it's not completely traditional. It has to do with cloud. If you're using cloud as part of your disaster recovery strategy, or if public cloud is tied up in that somehow, what does that look like? There's a whole bunch of different approaches that you can take with different cost benefits, different time to recovery, and so on. And it turns out, Ned, you know a thing or two about this topic because you've implemented some disaster recovery solutions for your customers. That's true, isn't it? Fight me.
That is true. I don't think we need to fight about this. Can't we get along and have a sandwich together or something?
Maybe I don't know how that meme works. I don't know. Maybe I'm not. I'm too old, maybe.
So the important thing is that is true. I worked for a VAR/consulting agency for 6 years, and we did disaster recovery projects for a number of different customers in different scenarios. And in addition to that, we actually, because we did so many of these, we developed a solution around disaster recovery that was really focused on the planning aspect of it and not so much the technology. But I hate to say that technology is the easy side, because technology is still hard. But when you try to herd the cats that is IT and compliance and developers and all this other type of people for disaster recovery, you'll realize that, no, technology really is the easy part on that.
I like that you're brave enough to put it out that way, that the technology is the easy part, because any of us that have worked on disaster recovery plans, particularly if there was a high degree of automation intended where the disaster recovery was meant to flip to the backup site or whatever the intent was automatically, knows that it is horrifyingly difficult and complex and with all kinds of ways to get yourself tripped up. So to say that the tech is the easy part and the culture is the hard part, oh my, we better have some good discussions here, Ned. And you know, you would mention plan. That is going to be the focus of our discussion if you're out there listening to this. The planning, the how to think about disaster recovery, and the major considerations for different disaster recovery approaches are the key parts of this discussion today. And yeah, we're going to mention some tech along the way. You know, towards the end of the show, we're going to point you in the direction of some different products coming from different vendors, just so you kind of have an idea. Yeah, what these people do or what this product's all about is disaster recovery. Maybe now that you've got your plan really nailed down and you know exactly what you're doing, then you can figure out how those products might fit into that plan. So now let's start at the beginning here. Why bother with DR? Because here's the sad truth. How many companies have both of us worked with over the years that didn't really have one? So why would we bother?
Why would the companies bother? Because they don't want to go out of business, I guess, is probably a good reason.
It's obvious, isn't it? Right? I mean, it's the whole business continuity thing. If your IT's gone, can you do your business anymore? And in the vast case of most companies, no. So let me put a finer point on it. Let's say I've made a big commitment to the cloud. I'm up in the cloud. Hey, aren't they all disaster proof, right? If all my stuff's in the cloud, do I really need a DR strategy?
Ooh, wow. Wow. That's a bold question. The answer is yes. Of course you do. Just because it's somebody else's. Well, I don't like to say it's somebody else's computers, because there's a lot more to it than that. But yes, you still need some sort of disaster recovery planning. The nice thing is a lot of the cloud providers have some sort of disaster recovery utility or tool or service built into their cloud. So if you plan to just continue to use their cloud as your DR strategy, replicating to a different region or something, there's a lot of built-in functionality that helps you do that. Of course, you do have to think about this scenario where an entire cloud goes down, and you might be like, man, does an entire cloud ever go down? IBM cloud did. It went down for 4 hours.
Or certainly entire regions go down. IBM cloud, like the whole thing, that's pretty horrifying. But wow. But yeah, that as unlikely as that seems, that can actually happen.
Right. So no cloud is entirely immune to what the ingenuity of humans and being able to break things. So with that in mind, you have to plan around that. But a big portion of that is doing the cost benefit analysis. So if you know that downtime is going to cost you X amount, say, you know, $100,000 a day for every day you're down, you have to balance that against the cost of the complexity of your solution. So it might be relatively easy to set up replication to another region if you're using AWS or Azure, and the likelihood of a whole region going down is pretty slim, and it's probably not going to be down for more than a day. Okay, then I'm willing to bet the money on that. On the other hand, if you are, you know, making millions of dollars an hour off of some high frequency trading app or something, if AWS goes down, you're losing millions of dollars. Yeah, you need DR that can point at something that's not AWS.
Or you're somewhere in the middle. Like we had, there's news this week of Garmin being under a cyber attack where they got some encryption malware that's been running through their systems, and they had to proactively shut everything down, their entire system, to avoid their most crucial data center server being encrypted and held for ransom. I mean, that yet another scenario.
Yes. And I mean, I don't know the internals of Garmin at all. I'm assuming they're probably running on AWS, if I had to guess. But the theory is, like, if they were had been replicating their data to Azure in a write once, read many type of fashion, then maybe they could have protected themselves against the ransomware attack. Who knows? I mean, I'm speculating, but those are the type of things you have to think about, and how much damage was actually done to Garmin's reputation, and how much money did they lose by having their systems go offline? I'd argue for them, probably not that much. I mean, honestly, am I going to go out and buy a completely different device and family of devices just because my Garmin data was unavailable for a couple of days? Yeah, probably not.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. Yeah, I've got a fancy Garmin watch, and I've got a Garmin. I forget the device, but it's the orange thing where if you're in the wilderness and things go bad, you press the button and a helicopter appears, that kind of thing. Am I going to go, you know, swap out to a different ecosystem because they had a bad day due to some nasty hackers? No. Did it cost them something? Yeah. I'm sure if we were to look at that infrastructure, I bet it's impeccably designed, but cyber attack, you know, that took out basically everything or put them in a position where they needed to shut everything off. So there's lots of reasons to plan for disaster recovery, for sure. So here's a question more about cloud versus a physical site, Ned. So a lot of the disaster recovery stuff that I've worked with in the past, public cloud wasn't really on the table as a disaster recovery site. It was more like, okay, we've got these two colo facilities, one's in SuperNAP in Las Vegas, and one's in this location here. And, you know, we're building out dual sites, and the intent is that one site's going to take over if the other site goes down. I guess you'd call that what, old school, traditional kind of thing. So why think about public cloud as a possible place to do disaster recovery?
I mean, money. Money's probably the main motivating factor. But let me break that down a little bit. If you're running one site and you want to set up DR, you got to stand up another site. You got to pay the co-location fees, the power, the cooling. You've got to have physical hardware there. And that physical hardware needs to be able to handle whatever load you're going to be swapping over to that site if something goes down.
I like that you optimistically just said that. Because what's the reality? I know for me, bunch of it's like, okay, disaster recovery site is the leftover crap that we replaced last year at our main data center. We're going to put that over into the DR site because that's a way we can reuse that equipment and you know, depreciate those assets even longer kind of thing. Can they handle the load? Would you actually to need them? No, but companies do that. That happens.
Yeah. And I hope you remembered to keep all that old equipment under support. Because when you fire it all up, it's going to break. Yeah, that was my experience as well. I did DR for a healthcare organization, and their standard operating practice was after 3 years, the equipment would leave their primary data center and it would go over to their secondary data center, which was their DR/dev/testing kind of facility. And it kind of served all of those functions, which made DR challenging. sometimes.
Boy. Yeah. So you're arguing then that rather than do that, public cloud offers you a cost-effective alternative way to build out a DR site.
Sure. Yeah, and it really depends on what kind of DR site you want to run. There are different options out there, and it probably helps if I describe them a little bit. These are it's the terminology that I've heard the most, so these might be familiar to some listeners out there. One is a cold site. So that's a site where nothing's turned on. You're replicating your data to a certain degree, but you have nothing currently running there. So you have to fire all of the virtual machines or even physical machines up and load your data in. It takes the longest, but it's probably the cheapest in terms of cost.
So you say replicating data, that would mean I'm replicating storage data and database data, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, typically you'd be doing array-based replication or database-based replication. Or, I mean, if you want to go really old school, you are backing up to tape and then moving those tapes over to your DR site.
That's very cold. That's an Antarctic style of a DR. That's very,
please
very cold
don't do
indeed.
That. I've been through those exercises and they're awful.
But the point is, you do have a copy of your data that's more or less current. You're pretty close to current. That is being kept offsite so that you can, when the time comes, turn everything on, point everything to the storage, point everything to the database, fire it up, and you should be up and running again. It's not instant. That's why it's a quote-unquote cold site. But it's cheap to go that route.
Absolutely. The next option would be pilot light. And this is the idea that you have some resources running and actively replicating and ready to take over. And these would usually be your shared services and maybe like a scaled down version of your most important applications. So think you probably have a domain controller running over there. You probably have your vSphere environment maybe running. And if you've got a really important whiz-bang web app, well, maybe that is warmed up and ready to go. You would just have to scale it out. And that would be like a pilot light site. So you've got a couple things running, but not everything.
So pilot light, like as in a gas stove, that little pilot light that sits there and burns. So when you go to turn on the main burner, the pilot light kicks it all off and it comes up much more quickly. You're still burning a little bit of gas to keep that pilot light running, but it's not a full burn that's happening. Not everything's live. So there's still time involved to get switched over to that, but it's a lot more ready to go than a cold site scenario.
Absolutely. And then the next step up from that would be a warm site where you have everything running and kind of ready to take over. And you would have to do the failover, but your DR site is not accepting active traffic in any way. It's not involved in your day-to-day operational traffic. It's just there in the background, but it is running the full workload. So it's ready to go, ready to take over.
But just not transactionally live, you're saying. There's nothing. So it's like an active standby scenario.
Right.
Okay.
But that standby is like ready to take over. It's like a read-only copy of a database, right? But you can switch it over to write. The last one is a hot site, and you almost never see this because it's really hard to do. But it basically means active. You are actively sending traffic and requests to both sites. And in a failure type scenario, you just fail all the traffic to the site that's still working. That's really hard to do.
Yeah, I know why it's hard to do. Part of it's money, part of it's just application design from a technical perspective. But can I just say I'm a fan of the hot site, the active scenario? If you can afford it, and I understand it means you've got a lot of capacity sitting there that maybe you're not using, because the whole idea of active is you can't go over 50% utilization at either site, because then when you fail over, now you've got that other site needing to pick up the slack for the other one. So you do end up with some idle capacity. But what it gives you is a fully working, known, good technical solution that's there. It's just a matter of capacity management at that point. And historically, I've dealt with some of these scenarios where that's viable, because it's not, as long as your applications can support it, you can go from warm site to hot site if your application architecture can cope with it and you've got your inter-site replication strategy really buttoned down. But then it's the money thing, because what C-level wants to look at, why do we have 50%, ideally more than 50% idle capacity at each site? I don't want to pay for all this stuff just sitting there. And maybe we'll get into this later, Ned, but I was hoping that in the cloud era, and elastic workloads and such, you know, Kubernetes magic, perhaps, that you could have active-active and not really have that idle capacity problem that is such a turnoff.
Well, that's exactly where I was going, because we painted this picture of these different models that you can function in. And obviously, hot site's the most expensive, cold site is the cheapest in traditional DR. But all of these assume that you're running a site of some kind with some capacity there. What does cloud bring to the table? Well, it brings a few things. Probably the most important is that elasticity of the cloud. If I want to run Pilot Lite and just have a few instances running, when I need to scale out, I can just ask for that capacity. I don't have to purchase the physical hardware upfront. I don't have to purchase all the capacity upfront. I can just request that on demand and know that it's going to be there. So that means you're spending a lot less.
I like the way you say, I want to run Pilot Lite, because it sounds like an open source project that we haven't heard of yet or something. But I get your point. What about, do you think there's a case to be made there with warm site or hot site and public cloud?
So the most common implementation that I have seen is usually either the Pilot Lite or the warm site, and it's actually a decision that's made per application. You have your shared services that are providing authentication and DNS and those types of things, but then beyond that, you have your individual applications, and some applications are just more important than others. So one of the exercises that you go through when you're doing your disaster recovery planning is to assign different tiers to your applications and figure out which are the most important applications for, you know, bringing money into the company or whatever service you provide. Those need to be up and available the quickest. So those you might go with an active-active configuration or at least active standby. And then you have your services that only run once a month or once a year, or your applications that are just supporting applications that could be down for 4 hours or 12 hours or whatever. Those can be in a cold state. So it's not an all or nothing decision. And when it comes to cloud, it's a lot easier to make that decision because you know you can spin up those resources whenever you need to. And we haven't talked about this yet. I'm sure we'll get to testing, but cloud also enables you to test a lot easier.
I'm laughing here because you're like, oh, you got to define your tiers of applications. Well, Ned, come on, man. They're all equally important. Don't make us choose. It's always a difficult conversation to have with a customer to get them to identify which the most critical ones are. And sometimes the things that run once a month or the things that run, you know, once a quarter or something might be financially related. So, yeah, they can tolerate a little bit of downtime, but from how important they are, they really do matter. So you want to make sure they're working. They really matter a lot when by the time comes for them to matter. Ned, you'd mentioned planning, and we had hit that at the top of the show too, the criticality of the disaster recovery plan. What does a disaster recovery plan look like? And I think maybe we need to distinguish between what it looks like from a business perspective and what it looks like from a technical perspective, because in my experience, those are certainly related, but kind of two different things.
Right. So we should probably differentiate between business continuity and disaster recovery, because those are related, but they are separate. Business continuity is how does the business as a whole continue to function if something goes wrong? So if the CEO dies in a plane crash, that's important. That's not technical. That's something that needs to be dealt with in the business continuity.
Right.
If something happens to a data center and the people in the data center, now you need business continuity and DR, because you need to plan for how are you going to, you know, make sure that you have the personnel in place to do this failover, and then how are you actually going to do the failover? So when it comes to disaster recovery planning, you're thinking more about the technical side of things. How are you actually going to fail over applications and continue to provide technology services to the business? And then the business has its whole continuity planning for how it is going to continue to function in a disaster.
And those plans, again, don't stand alone, but they are different things, different concerns with different action items and processes and workflows for different tiers of the organization to follow. So for example, from a technical and engineering perspective, for disaster recovery, we usually dealt with a playbook in various of the companies that I've worked with over time. And the playbook had a plan. This is the scenario. You need to accomplish X because this particular disaster or failure scenario has happened, go march through, and there were checklists and there were milestones and so on to get to the point of we are now in a recovered state technically, and we are moving ahead.
Right, exactly. So your disaster recovery plan needs to define a few things. First of all, what's a disaster? You need to define what you consider a disaster.
Yep.
You need to outline your applications and figure out what the dependency is between applications, which is not a trivial exercise by itself.
Yep.
Because you suddenly realize, oh, that one database server, that serves 8 different applications from the same database server. So in order to recover any of those, I need to recover the database server first.
Yeah,
that's kind of important.
8 applications that we'll admit to and 13 more that we'd forgotten about. But yeah, exactly.
Exactly. So you need to figure out that dependency. And then as part of that, you need to figure out the tiering of your applications. So that's all part of the planning. And we haven't even gotten to like the runbook yet. The runbook is like way, way down the line. We're not even close to there. Because now you need to tabletop. If everything goes down, how do we declare a disaster? And what are the first steps to actually meeting that disaster? Which applications have to come up first? Which ones come up after that? So you have this whole order figured out. And you need validations for all that. How do we validate that each application is up and functional? And people tend to skip this a little bit, but you also need to figure out how you fail back. So yes, when do you consider the disaster over? When do you consider your original environment stable? And then what is the process for announcing and failing back your applications?
Can I just once again put my flag in the ground for the active? Because that's another one of those problems that goes away, the failback. Anyway,
yeah.
Well, it mostly goes away, but yeah, anyway. Okay. So this is, I wanted to highlight the point you made about the dependencies. You got to get that right because your technology stack is quite literally that, where there's foundational building blocks you got to bring up before the other stuff. And so you do need to get that down. And we haven't talked about testing, but obviously testing is a key part of this plan to validate not just now that you got it right, but it's still right a quarter from now when things in your technology stack have changed, to validate that everything in your runbook and so on is all functional as expected when the disaster recovery needs to happen. So you're not sitting there trying to figure out, oh, crap, we added that other server, and now if we don't bring that up, the whole other thing's going to fall over. You don't want to be thinking about that during the panic time.
Right. Another thing that should be in that planning document is defining the RPO and RTO for your different tiers of applications.
Please explain those TLAs, Ned.
Yay! Oh, I've explained these a lot of times. So your RPO is your recovery point objective. So that is the point at which you would like to recover from. Now, it sounds a little weird. So what does that mean? It means if I have my application and I'm taking sort of snapshots of it in, say, 10-minute increments, I'm willing to lose up to 10 minutes of data when I fail over, because I'm taking these 10-minute slices and I replicate them over to my disaster recovery site. If I have to bring that application up, I'm okay with losing the 10 minutes, up to 10 minutes between the snapshots being replicated. That's a 10-minute RPO.
Right. Like in storage, you can go as radical as I need to see a transactional commitment to the storage array, both to the primary and the failover storage, before I'm going to actually acknowledge back to the storage client that requested the write. And it's got to write to both arrays before I acknowledge that, which can really slow things down a bit. But if you're super critical, your RPO, it means you have no tolerance for any out of sync, any shift in time, if you will, between sites.
Right. You're not okay with any data loss. So you have an RPO of 0. That's really expensive. So generally speaking, the lower the RPO, the more expensive that is to do, which is why it's important to tier your applications and figure out, okay, this application is actually critical and an RPO of 0 is what we need to do. The other acronym is RTO, which is recovery time objective. And that's how long it takes you to recover that application in the disaster recovery environment. So if you are doing more of, say, like a cold site for one of your applications, so you need to recover that application from a backup and build the virtual machines that it runs on and all that kind of jazz, you might have a recovery time objective of 4 to 6 hours. something that has an RPO of zero might also have an RTO of zero, meaning you're running it active. So if something goes down, you fail it over. There's no downtime. There's no recovery time. It's just available.
And but just again, like RPO. It goes back to expense. It's a lot of times you'll pitch the disaster recovery. The C-level will say, well, of course, we want instantaneous recovery. That will be $50 million. We do not want instantaneous recovery.
Nope. Yeah,
once it's like everything else, it costs money.
Oh, once you add numbers, it suddenly becomes very real.
Yeah.
And you also have to think about the order in which you're recovering your applications. So if you have a dependency tree and your RTO for your tier one and maybe tier two is like 2 hours, then you have to build that time into the applications you're going to recover after that, because they might be dependent on those applications being recovered. So if your RTO is 4 hours for tier three, well, okay, it's actually going to take you 8 hours to recover because you have those dependencies. So just you have to think through that mental model and plan accordingly.
I think you can calculate an ROI on RPO and RTO, more TLAs.
I mean, pretty not well. Not a TCO, but... You know, that would just be madness.
In the sense of you can calculate that ROI, because if you do know from a business perspective, being down for an hour costs X dollars, which with certain businesses, you can do that. So for example, I brought up an example of payment cards because that was an environment I worked in for several years. That was a known cost per hour because we knew how much money we made processing transactions. If we were unable to process cards, we lost money that probably maybe was coming back, but most of that money was probably gone. So you can justify a more aggressive RPO and RTO if you have that sort of metric within your organization. Other companies I worked for, it kind of didn't matter. It could have been a 24-hour RTO, and that would have been inconvenient perhaps, but okay, you know, acceptable, because it was so much cheaper to go that route.
Right.
So Ned, with RPO and RTO and again, public cloud, does public cloud change these things at all? Or is this, we're still kind of at the, you know, at the planning and thought stage, or does public cloud kind of change the RPO RTO equation at all?
I think it changes the RTO a little bit. Especially if you were typically running a pilot light or a cold site, now the recovery time to bring up a whole fleet of virtual machines is going to be a lot lower in the public cloud. If you think about what you would have to spin up in a cold site or even a pilot light site, now if you're in the cloud, if you want to request, I don't know, 100 EC2 instances, you're going to have those in, you know, 15, 20 minutes, as opposed to spinning up 100 virtual machines in an environment. That's going to be very difficult to do. Another thing that is a lot easier to do is automate builds in the cloud. I won't say it's easy, but it's easier to do. So if you have prerequisites and ways that you need to build these virtual machines, it's a little bit easier to script that out in the cloud than it would be in a traditional data center, because the tool sets are just there, you know? And that makes a world of difference when it comes to building infrastructure in the cloud.
How does automation, that's really the direction you're going in, how does automation, do you trust it, Ned? I think is really the question I'm asking. So let me give you a scenario. So back in the day, let's say there was some disaster recovery where it needed to be automated. We would detect a failure scenario, and then we could, in theory, automate the kickover of DNS so that new IP addresses would be mapped to the host names that would send traffic to the alternate site. And maybe some routing needed to be done. Maybe we needed to announce a different BGP route to the internet or something, or withdraw route or something, so that traffic would go to the other site. We could have automated a lot of that stuff, but because of corner cases and various concerns, we didn't. We were scared, Ned. We were just scared.
You weren't scared.
What's your take on these sort of scenarios with public cloud, considering how much more robust we have automation tools today and so on?
I'd say trust but verify. That's probably what it comes down to. Trust your automation up to a point, but that actual lever where you're switching it over from one site to another or one DNS entry to another, you're going to have some automated verification, but that last step is probably still going to be a manual step, because someone's going to want to validate that all the test results came out okay and run maybe a few test transactions of their own before they're ready to give it the A-OK, let's flip over. So all the cases that I saw with the exception of active sites, going back to your favorite, with the exception of those, all the other cases, it would be a manual last step with everything else as automated as possible. Today's episode of Day 2 Cloud is sponsored by Datadog, a monitoring platform for cloud-scale infrastructure and applications. Datadog provides dashboarding, alerting, application performance monitoring, and log management in one tightly integrated platform so you can get end-to-end visibility quickly. And it integrates seamlessly with AWS so you can start monitoring EC2, RDS, ECS, and all your other AWS services in minutes. Visualize key metrics, set alerts to identify anomalies, and collaborate with your team to troubleshoot and fix issues fast. Try it yourself by starting a free 14-day trial and installing the agent. Plus, you'll get a free Datadog t-shirt. Visit datadog.com/day2cloud to get started. That's datadog.com/daytwocloud to get started.
Well, then that means we got to talk about planning and practice. Even, well, whether it's manual or fully automated, you've got to be thinking about what happens when the disaster recovery actually hits and are we ready? It's not 3 years ago we had that consultant in and they told us we were good. No. You need to have a routine, some kind of a process where you're testing and validating your disaster recovery site. Now, in the places I've worked where they took disaster recovery very seriously, that meant we are moving live traffic over to the disaster recovery site. There was a window, perhaps we would notify, maybe not like a public notification, but like key customers, just in case they, you know, might have been impacted or something. Hey, we're doing our DR testing. It's happening at this time during these windows, but this is a live fire exercise effectively.
Right.
That's how we did it. And during that time, we were validating everything. Application processes were there. All the VMs were up and running. All the storage replication was actually working. We could attract traffic to that site in the time frame that was expected. We could process transactions there. And then we could fail back. It was an active standby, like a warm site scenario that we were dealing with. But it was a very big deal, and it happened quarterly. We had to do it every quarter, and inevitably, we found stuff. Usually little stuff. It was like, we got to tweak the runbook for this little thing. Kind of forgot about that. Oops. And it was a really critical exercise for us. So what are your thoughts on all of this, Ned?
Well, in that particular case, you were the exception and not the rule. I used to give a presentation about this, and I had some stats, so I pulled up the presentation, and this was based off a Forrester study in 2017, but I'm sure nothing has changed. So of all companies that they polled, 81% ran their DR drill once a year or less. So quarterly was, that was 7% of respondents. Not great. So if you think about, and you said you would catch things. So, you know, even running it quarterly, there would be stuff that was out of date or needed to be changed or fixed or remedied. Imagine if you're doing a DR test once a year, how many things have changed over the course of a year?
I mean, in defense of the people that are doing it once a year, I guess the answer is that it depends, right? Because in our scenario, we were actively growing, deploying new applications, releasing new products. And so there was a pretty steady churn that we all kind of knew something's changed. We better, you know, doing the quarterly disaster recovery testing was sort of like obvious. We just knew that we needed to do that because of all that churn. Other businesses, they can be pretty static where not a lot is changing. And so maybe they feel justified and like, it'll be fine. It'll be fine, Ned.
You would think that, but most businesses that I've ever worked with still have change within their IT environment over the course of a year. And that change is not always tracked in the DR docs. In fact, the DR docs are almost the last thing that anybody looks at or updates until it's testing time.
Because who's updating the primary docs, let alone the disaster recovery docs?
Right. And what's the motivation to do it at any other time in the year? So the metaphor that I liked to use, and because I run a lot, this is the metaphor that popped into my head. If I asked you once a year with zero preparation to run a marathon, do you think you could do it?
No, sir. I am quite certain that I could not.
I would argue you probably could make it through the 26 miles, but you would be an absolute wreck at the end.
I wouldn't be running it. I'd be walking it. Maybe I could limp and walk my way through it. Well, sore feet and very sad. But yeah, okay.
It would take you a long time. You would be pretty banged up after it. And that is the exact same thing I saw at DR tests when I would go to like SunGuard and watch these people who had been cooped up in a room for 3 days straight running through DR tests and troubleshooting everything that went wrong along the way. They were wrecked. Don't be that person. So by doing it quarterly, you now have the motivation to keep your docs up to date. You have the motivation to automate stuff because you're doing it more than once a year. So now you see the value in automating components of your disaster recovery. And you have a higher likelihood of success, which means that each test takes less time than the tests that you do annually. So it's less disruptive to the business, too.
It's the logic of doing small incremental software releases rather than once a year, here's the big software release with the 8,000 changes. No, you're de-risking it in a sense if you do those quarterly, tiny, incremental, do the testing that gives you the opportunity to do those tiny, incremental updates that you need to do rather than 3 days in the war room being completely wrecked.
Right. And you're practicing, and practice makes you better at something. So if you, it's the same principle for releasing new software. And like you said, in small increments, often you get really good at releasing software and knowing what to test and look for when you do that release, which means that overall your code becomes more stable. Apply the same principle to DR. Overall, your DR becomes more stable the more you test. And obviously there's an upper limit to that. It can't be so disruptive to your organization that it, you know, pulls you away from your day job. But just imagine if you didn't have to spend that 3 or 4 days in SunGuard fighting everything because nothing's been updated since last year. Now, the test takes a few hours on a Friday and you've got your weekend back. That'd be nice. And it's actually realistic.
Yeah, well, that practice is such a big deal. Anything you don't practice, you begin to lose it over time. So, for example, I've been doing some lab work with some configuration stanzas I haven't typed in a long time. The muscle memory's there, but I had to kind of resurrect it and rebuild it and put those synaptic connections back together because they kind of just faded out of my brain over time. Faded is the right way to put it. They're not gone, just like, oh, I remember that. Yeah. I got to do this and this step to make this thing happen.
Right.
When you don't practice it, it just fades out. Music's the same thing. There's a piece of music you haven't seen for a long time and you haven't practiced it. You don't, it's kind of there, but not really. And then you practice it. It's like, oh, all right, it starts coming back. But the more you practice it, then it's like, it's more like muscle memory and it's reflexive and you can just kind of do it. Disaster recovery is one of those things that you don't practice it because you really don't think you're ever going to need it because, nah, we're never going to have a disaster. And in fact, you really want, during that time of performance, you're standing on stage performing the music. You're doing the thing that needs all that practice. You don't want to have to think. You just want it to happen without you staring deeply into the playbook. The playbook should be a nice reference in case you need it, not the crutch you're leaning on so heavily during the crisis.
Right. And this is, again, where cloud kind of helps out. If you want to do a lot of practice, you can build a net new environment in the cloud and then tear it all down. And you're only pay for what was turned on while it was turned on. Even if you have like a disaster recovery warm site running in the cloud, you can basically make a copy of that through whatever scripts you use to create it, create that copy, copy some data over and run through the exercise of just doing it in a bubble to see if it works. And you could do that on an almost monthly basis for particular applications that are the most important, and then just update the runbook based off of what you've learned and just make that part of your cycle. And because you could spin up 5 environments, you could test each, you could have different people testing different applications in their own little bubble environment in the cloud and then tear them all down. So you get really good at building an environment. You get really good at testing in that environment. And when the actual disaster happens, you are seasoned. You don't feel like, my God. Because that's the other thing. Like when a disaster happens, people are stressed. They might not be thinking clearly. They tend to freak out a little bit. And from that, bad decisions are born. So if you've practiced this thing, when the crisis hits, you can fall back on that practice, fall back on that training, and just do the thing as opposed to freaking out and making a lot of bad, poor decisions.
So case in point, I did face a couple of disaster scenarios. One was a data center down. We had one data center that was completely out. We had to execute disaster recovery to swing all traffic to the alternate site. We did it pretty quick. We knew what was up and we were processing on the other site. Scared to death the whole time was happening. Oh my gosh, we're down to the one data center. We got to get this other data center back online quickly. Ah, so there was that, but failing over wasn't a problem. We were practiced. We knew what was going on. Another scenario was we did a preemptive disaster recovery. I guess that's not what that would be called, but we're not recovering at that point. But there was a hurricane tracking towards one of our facilities. Mm-hmm. And so as a preventative measure, we decided while this desperate weather window is bearing down on us, we're going to swing traffic to the other site. So we did it. Okay, we're processing on the other site now. When the hurricane's back or gone, we're going to go back to the way we were and you'll kind of load balance between the two sites. Again, when you are under the gun, that's not the time to be freaking out. You just want to be a well-oiled machine getting the job done.
The other thing to think about in that scenario is, what if the two data centers you traditionally run are 50 miles apart and you've got a hurricane coming? Well, 50 miles apart doesn't really help you when there's a hurricane coming. It seemed like a great idea.
Should never.
It was like, no. I remember, you know, when all the companies in New York realized they needed a disaster recovery plan, so they just replicated to data centers that were basically in New Jersey, and it was more than 50 miles away, so that was A-OK, and I was like, no, probably not.
I mean, it's tempting architecturally, too, because you have low network latency, you can probably get some big pipes between those facilities, and it just feels good, but no. No, because right. Certain disasters are going to impact both sites. You really got to have some spread there.
Right.
Which so, in my case happened to be up and down the East Coast, one site in Florida, one site way up in New England near the Boston area.
Right.
And so, yeah, no threat of hurricanes that way.
Right. You tend to build these sites where you already have an office because you're just adding a data center to an existing office or something.
Yes.
Instead of doing that, if you can leverage the cloud, you can plop your DR wherever you want, because the public clouds have regions across the entire globe. So if you want to have a West Coast instance and an East Coast instance, you can do that. If you want one over in the European Union, you could do that. Like, whatever makes sense for you, you have that optionality and you don't have to build a new data center or, God forbid, have to go into a co-location provider and go through that whole arrangement of signing leases and making sure that you're, you know, getting your power requirements correct because you're paying 3 years up front and all that kind of stuff. It's like, no, I just spun up some stuff in, you know, AWS London and I'm good to go.
Well, then we've talked a lot about planning, a lot about the different kinds of disaster recovery strategies that there are. Let's talk briefly about products, and there are some companies that specialize in this, and then the public cloud providers themselves have their own products. I guess we don't need to go deep, but maybe just kind of make some folks aware that once you've got your plan and your strategy in place, then you can look to some products that would help you out. So, you know, for example, I ran across Amazon Web Services. AWS has Cloud Indoor, which they say it's a whole company all by itself underneath the AWS umbrella. I was like, really? It's its own company? So it must be something they take quite seriously, but
no,
it's called Cloud Indoor. Oh, you don't think it's serious?
Well, no, it is serious, but they bought Cloud Indoor. That's why it's its own company. It was an acquisition.
I get it.
So Cloud Indoor was its own thing. And I think they specialized in disaster recovery for AWS because AWS didn't have a native service to do that. It didn't have a native service to do things like replicate EBS snapshots from one region to another for a while. Like, they added on some functionality after the fact, but AWS has really done their best to keep their regions as separate as possible. And so they relied on third parties to provide any kind of replication or management for that. Cloud Indoor did that. And then AWS was like, well, maybe we should just buy you. You do a good job. You keep doing a good job for us. And so that's okay. And it's integrated into the AWS console and all that kind of stuff. It was largely driven because of the success of Azure's site recovery service, which was getting a lot of traction as a disaster recovery solution. And AWS finally said, you know, maybe we need to have our own in-house DR solution. Let's pick up this other company.
Well, you mentioned Azure Site Recovery. We were talking about AWS Cloud Indoor. Now, both of those seemed kind of architecturally related, where you could have your own on-premises data center be replicating data up to the cloud via Azure Site Recovery or AWS Cloud Indoor. And it was like a warm site scenario, DR site scenario, where what you're replicating from your on-premises facility up into the cloud was sitting there ready to go when you needed it. You'd have to do a few things to make it work. Am I kind of in the ballpark?
You're kind of in the ballpark. I have not worked with Cloud Indoor, so I can't comment on exactly how that works. The Azure Site Recovery, or ASR, that replicates your data into Azure Storage. And then in a failover scenario, you actually you create a plan for recovery and you execute the plan, and the plan actually spins up the Azure VMs and loads the data into those virtual machines. So it would almost be, I won't say a cold site, but it's not really a warm site either, because your virtual machines aren't like running actively, which is why I've seen ASR, because ASR is actually fairly inexpensive. I've seen it combined with more expensive solutions that do near real-time replication to a currently running virtual machine in Azure for those really important workloads that need an RPO of almost zero. So you could combine two products together, one for your really, really low RPO that has like direct machine-to-machine replication, and then ASR could handle your less important workloads because the RTO is a little bit longer. It's still not very long. I've seen 4 terabyte machines recovered in 2 hours. So it does a pretty good job. But that being said, it's not instantaneous. Whereas if you were replicating something directly with a running VM up in Azure, it would be different.
The scenario I painted here for these was your own on-premises data center, disaster recovery in the cloud. Is that typical? And if that's typical, is that what we're limited to?
I think that's where a lot of organizations are starting. I will say the ASR product had the capability of replicating between 2 data centers and using Azure as just the control plane for the replication and the failover. So you can actually have a data center in Boston and one down in Florida, and the replication would be happening between the 2 sites, but it would be managed by Azure Site Recovery running up in Azure, and that would be your control plane. So that's absolutely an option. I don't know about Cloud Indoor, but there's other technologies that sort of leverage the cloud in a similar way to provide that control plane and sort of software as a service. And then you just run an appliance or multiple appliances in each data center to handle the replication and failover process.
We've been picking on these, I guess you'd call them cloud native services, or at least services that are native to their respective worlds, you know, Cloud Indoor with AWS and Azure Site Recovery and Azure Backup that both tie into the Microsoft Azure world. But we don't have time to go through all these, Ned, but it's worth pointing out Google Cloud, they've got a product that fits into disaster recovery, and so does IBM Cloud. And NetApp certainly plays in this space. And I guess you could put Veeam and maybe Zerto in this space as well. Certainly they have components that could play a role here.
Right. Again, it's all about that RTO and RPO. So if you are using a traditional backup product, like Veeam is traditionally used for backup and recovery, if you're using that and you have a lower RTO and RPO, you could use Veeam, replicate your copies up, or copy your copies up to the cloud, and then recover them there using Veeam software. That's a capability that they've added for, I think, Azure and AWS. Zerto is more of that real-time replication. So you could combine those two products and harmoniously create a DR that makes sense for you. Personalized.
Does VMware play in this space at all?
It does, but typically VMware to VMware type migrations, at least, or disaster recovery, as far as I know. So their product is called SRM, Site Recovery Manager, and it can either use array-based replication if you have traditional storage arrays, or it can use, I think it's called VRA, which was like VMware's replication appliance. It does the replication at the ESX layer as opposed to the storage array layer, so it can just intercept writes and send them to the other matching appliance in the other site. So you could use that to replicate to, you know, VMware on AWS, or I'm sure VMware on any of the other clouds, but it doesn't really leave the VMware ecosystem, as it were.
So maybe VMware on AWS plays into this somehow, where you've got a local, an on-premises VMware, you've got VMware on AWS, and then between SRM, maybe HCX plays a role, mm-hmm. and some other TLAs. You can cobble together a strategy if you're, you know, heavily in the VMware ecosystem, and that's how you want to keep it. That's where you want to keep your workloads.
Oh, that is a key use case for VMware and AWS, and one of their main selling points is here is a easy way to get DR. And because you can scale up the number of hosts in your VMware on AWS instance, you could have just like, I think the 3 hosts, that's a minimum. And then if you have a disaster, you could just add additional hosts to scale out your VMware environment to handle whatever load you need, and then drop those hosts after the disaster's over.
At the top of the show, Ned, I invoked the magical and sacred word, Kubernetes. And yet we haven't really talked about it in the show at all. Any thoughts there about the role going forward that Kubernetes plausibly could play in DR, even if there's not defined patterns for it today?
Yeah, there's not a whole lot of products that are playing in the DR space with Kubernetes. And I think a lot of that has to do with the statelessness of most Kubernetes workloads. Mm. So because the applications live in container images, and the configuration data lives outside in whatever you're using to deploy it, there's no data to replicate, as it were. That's usually in some sort of stateful system that right now is usually living outside of Kubernetes. And it's going to be like a database of some kind. So you still need to replicate that thing. And then for Kubernetes, you can just use whatever Helm charts or whatever other deployment thing you're using to stand up the application in the target environment and point it at that replicated state.
So for a very modern application, Kubernetes feels like a way you could get this job done, and more in that active-active scenario. It's got the scheduler that can do the scaling for you if you built out the apps that way. Mm-hmm. We're making the implication that the applications are stateless, as you pointed out. Not that they have to be in the Kubernetes world, but that is a pretty typical deployment model. And so you're in this scenario where, yeah, okay. So if I set up active-active where I can take transactions at any number of locations and one of those locations goes off-site, the other locations have to pick up the slack, you know, for the capacity. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what Kubernetes can do for you. It's kind of built into the core functionality of the thing. So it's a whole different approach. But it implies you've already got your data replication sorted out. You're already dealing with database synchronization and storage replication and so on. And now it's rather than disaster recovery, it's application architecture for business continuity, mm-hmm. is what you've got. And in theory, if you've spread out your application appropriately, you're never recovering from a disaster. It becomes a capacity management problem at that point.
Because it's in Kubernetes and you have automated your application build and deployment process, that automation work is now already done. And that's typically not true of older IaaS type applications. So you just have to run a Helm chart with the right configuration values and boom, you're done. Like, that makes life a lot easier. The caveat to all of that is the active-active nature means that you're going to have to find a way to either shard out your transactions or have one master copy that things are replicating to. And that could lead to transactional delays, depending on how you're structuring that. And that gets in a whole tangent on how to handle multi-master replication and stuff like that. So it's a really hard problem to crack.
It really is defined by your application architecture. It assumes you've solved a bunch of these other super challenging problems ahead of time. But if you get over that hurdle, not easy, but let's say you get over that hurdle, then you're having a different sort of disaster recovery conversation, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Takeaways, Ned, takeaways. You got, I got one big one, but let's start with you. What's your biggest takeaway?
I mean, the number one thing to do is plan. You need to go through the planning process before you select the technology, because until you plan, you don't even know what your technology requirements are. So kind of important.
yeah, planning, and you didn't take mine, because mine was test. My big one was test.
That was planning, my second one.
Yep, absolutely. Testing was the big one for me. It's not enough to have a disaster recovery plan. And like we were saying earlier, we had that consultant firm come in 3 years ago. We're good. No. You gotta test, and not just test once, but test regularly. That practice idea, keep everybody in tune with it. You got one more, Ned?
Yeah, and this one, I don't think we even talked about it, but when you are figuring out your disaster recovery and testing it, you have to involve more than the IT department. You can't do this alone. You need the application owners. You need the business units that are responsible for different products because they understand the requirements for that application and how to test it and what functionality looks like. You need to involve those people. Do not try to go this alone and cobble something together because it's going to be wrong. You're going to have to go down back to the drawing board when you're done. So just like get them involved from the beginning and it'll make life a lot easier at the end.
I don't know how we didn't have this part of the conversation earlier because, man, oh, man, the people that are consuming the applications are the only ones that can tell you that the application is indeed working as expected after the disaster recovery transition to the failover site has occurred. You can look at it as an IT person at all your consoles and all the lights are green now. And I ran some testy things and it seems fine. Not until that business stakeholder who relies on that app to do their job function confirms that it's working as expected. Do you know for certain that disaster recovery has been successful?
Right. Boy, oh absolutely.
Boy. Oh, so you got me all excited, Ned. You got me all excited. Well, let's wrap this show up, Ned. We've been going on for almost an hour here. We're 10 minutes over our artificial contrived 45-minute limit. Mm-hmm. Dude, pitch your Ned in the Cloud YouTube thing that you've been doing for a while. I don't know how many people know about that. You should tell goodness. Them.
Yes. So I have been doing, since May, I think, I have been doing a daily check-in. It's a daily 10-minute live stream on YouTube. And I cover a range of different topics. Mondays are professional development. Tuesdays are Terraform. Wednesdays are tech analysis. Thursdays are all about the edge. And Fridays are about HashiCorp Vault's certification. At least that's the layout right now, subject to change at any time. And I'm 84 episodes in at this point. So I've been doing it pretty consistently.
You keep them pretty tight. They're usually around 10, 12 minutes, something like that.
Yeah, it's small and it's easily consumable. It's not going to take up a ton of your time. And I'm just trying to get some good information out there. And I'd love people's feedback. So we'll include a link in the show notes. Tune in. Check it out and let me know what you think. Or if there's a topic you want me to cover, let me know that too. I'm happy to do it. And I'm happy to know that people are listening and maybe I'm making their lives a little bit better. I don't know. That's aspirational.
I'm going to pitch some stuff that I've been doing on YouTube at youtube.com/packetpushersnetwork. We've got a lot of videos that we put out. I've started a series called Packet Exchange. That's going to be coming out. It's been Tuesdays. We're actually shifting it to Fridays. And that's a once a week, 20-ish minutes. Sometimes I get a little long-winded, but it's about network automation. That's the major focus. We're going to talk about it. We're going to come up with some design principles, and then we're going to do a demo. And I've been running those for a while now. Not the 80-something episodes Ned's got of his daily check-in, but we're, the network automation's kind of a thing. And a lot of folks, Ned, seem like they don't even know where to start. And so the big idea is, let's get started. Let's just do some things and start getting some ideas. So right now we're focused on Python. Mm-hmm. We'll shift away from that and get into more infrastructure as code kind of things over time. I'm planning to do some Ansible work and some Terraform work. And hey, I'm excited because some of this stuff I know and a lot of the stuff I'm learning as I go. So it's pretty exciting. So learn along with me on a Packet Exchange on the Packet Pushers YouTube channel. And hey, all you listening, that is it. We are done. So if you made it this far, virtual high five for burning some battery life with us. Boom. And if you have suggestions for future shows, Twitter's easy. I'm at EC Banks. Ned is at Ned1313. Ned's got a form on his website, nedinthecloud.com, if you hate Twitter. Because I understand if you hate Twitter. I really do. I get it. Day2Cloud is part of the Packet Pushers podcast network, and Packet Pushers has a tasty free weekly newsletter that is Human Infrastructure Magazine, and you can subscribe worry-free. We do not share your info because we aren't awful humans, so you can click subscribe and know that we're not trying to screw you. We just want to share the best of IT with you. That's all. PacketPushers.net/newsletter. And hey, we also have a Slack channel, so you can embrace your tribe at PacketPushers.net/Slack, and you can embrace safely because it's virtual, so I hope to see you in there. And until then, just remember, cloud is what happens while IT is making other plans.